Committee on Judiciary will come to order. Today is Tuesday, February 10th. First item on the agenda is a public hearing on House Bill 2373. Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, all the bills before you today come to you from the Department of Justice. 2373 applies the license suspension provisions to all support enforcement matters, whether child support payments are in arrears, not just ongoing cases. Pretty much a technical bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. No amendments. This bill does not have a fiscal impact or revenue impact.
Is there any discussion on the bill? I want to announce that we have a written testimony from Brent Arvidson, which we'll take into account. And three witnesses.
I got it now. I can read it.
Margaret Olney.
Margaret Olney, Ronell Schenkel, and Carl Stecker. Please.
Correct.
You go ahead in any order, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Chairman Barker. My name is Margaret Olney. I'm Special Counsel to Attorney General John Kroger. And as this committee knows, the Department of Justice is wholly responsible for the child support program. And I just wanted to say a little bit briefly about the child support program in Oregon and then address this bill. The child support program is a federally mandated, it's a required program that is necessary to receive our TANF, our grants, our Temporary Assistance to Needy Families grants. Part of it that's in Title IV, the Social Security Act, sets out requirements for our child support plan that we need to comply with in order for us to be receiving the federal match. Our child support program hasn't been in existence, though, for a long time, since 1957, and our responsibility is to oversee the entire program, including the Division of Child Support, which provides services primarily to families that are currently or have at some point been on public assistance, as well as the contract with the district attorney's offices, not all of them, but many of them, to provide services for any family who requests and those are families that have not been on public assistance. We provide services for 10 counties directly ourselves for the private cases, and the district attorneys provided for approximately 26. Included in the families that we collect for in terms of Title IV, we have the TANF. We also have we're required to provide services for Medicare and Medicaid assistance, and as well as assistance for families where a child is in foster care or juvenile care. We are not a means or income-based program. We provide services to anybody who asks, and our services include establishing paternity, locating parents, establishing and modifying support orders, medical support orders, and enforcing the support orders. We do statewide accounting and distribution for and interstate services for all cases, including those in the private cases. And again, we're funded by about one-third state general funds and two-thirds of federal funds. And there are performance measures that we must meet in order to receive additional federal assistance, as well as state performance measures. House Bill 2273 is a relatively narrow bill that seeks to expand our ability to use a license suspension process to collect collect child support arrearages once an ongoing child support obligation ceases. So currently, the process, the license suspension has been an effective tool to negotiate agreements with obligors to pay their child support or else face the sanction of losing their license. And what we have discovered is that once a child support obligation ceases, that is, a child There's no longer a current child support obligation, but there are could be substantial arrearages. The parent says, goodbye, and we lose that enforcement mechanism. So this bill enables us to do that. I would note that we have that this is not an insignificant amount, and we're certainly not going to collect all of it, but there are 6,589 cases that are arrears only in our system, and the amount owed is over $101 million. I think, let me just see if there's anything, any specific additional pieces that I would like to point out for you. The level of compliance agreements that we get and from the child support program, we get about 103 compliance agreements each month using the license suspension tool. So it has been a useful way to collect funds from folks who would not otherwise pay.
I'll go next. Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ron L. Schenkel, also with the Attorney General's office, here today in support of House Bill 2273. I work for Attorney General Kroger and with Margaret Olney, and I'm not going to repeat all of what she said. I'm just going to point out to you in my written testimony that the history of this particular area of law in Oregon is fairly long. Oregon, because of all of you, gave us in 1995 the ability to run a pilot license suspension program, even before it was a federal mandate for all of the states. And then in 1997, sitting before this very committee, I was here with some of you maybe, when you gave us the full license suspension program in Oregon. And as Margaret pointed out, the way that we set that law up at the time, because of the concern about it being such a strong enforcement remedy, was just to use it on the child support cases where we have ongoing support and minor children in the household. We've been using this tool for well over 10 years. Our goal and our emphasis is to use it to get someone's attention and have them enter into compliance agreement. Our goal is not to suspend licenses. We completely understand if we take away a driver's license and an occupational license, we've taken away your ability to work until you get things back in place. So that is not the goal. As she indicated in her testimony, though, we are experiencing a situation where people are not able or are unwilling to pay their debts for great periods of time. We finally enter into an agreement with them. They are making payments, but then the monthly support ends and all bets are off. They stop making payments. You'll notice, and I want to point out, this is not because we have different information. It's a subset. In Margaret's testimony, she talked about the 6,589 cases. Those are the cases that currently at the time we took the statistical data run qualified under the law for potentially license suspension, but there are arrears only, so we're not using that tool. As a reminder, it's in my testimony, but what's in the statute that you gave us is to qualify for this tool, you have to miss at least 3 complete months of payments or be $2,500 in arrears. This is not a tool we use right up front on our cases for enforcement. In my testimony, you'll see that we had, again, at the time we took this data, 46,000 judgment-only cases in the system. So it's just a subset of about 6,500 of those that would meet this qualification and that we would be using this tool. It's certainly not every judgment-only case that we have on the system. But as Margaret indicated, we're talking about over $1 million in debt that is owed, that we could use this tool. It is not just debt to the state. It is debt to families. So that is why we have this bill before you. We think we have used it responsibly and respectfully in working with our obligors and obligees and would like to extend it to this type of cases.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carl Stecker. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County and appearing today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And we, of course, are very much supportive of this bill. The reasons that this bill has worked so well is with respect to self-employed individuals. Frankly, we get 70% of our collections or more from income withholding for those people that earn wages. Money is deducted directly from their paychecks, much as our taxes are. However, with regard to people that are self-employed, there's often an opportunity to be somewhat evasive. And not that certainly there are many upstanding citizens and the vast majority who do pay dutifully their support, but for those cases, sometimes that extra measure of prodding is necessary. The suspension of a license is a tremendous tool. We have secured large payments of arrearages from folks who have come into our office, made an agreement to avoid license suspension, and take care of their responsibilities. The dilemma that we face, though, are those cases where the child support ends, and maybe there's a large arrearage. The children have turned 18 or 21, whatever the case may be, and the support ceases, and yet they still owe $10,000. The tool is no longer available to us under current law. A classic example is a case we had involving an electrician locally, self-employed supervising electrician who had his own business and he hired other electricians. And frankly, we took him into court for contempt. He paid up over $20,000. We then, he was paying for a while. He stopped paying. We used the license suspension tool. We actually had to remove his ability to have a supervisory electrician's license. He came in and paid off roughly $10,000 and made an agreement. He didn't maintain that agreement. We suspended again. He paid. We reinstated. Finally, unfortunately, the support ended, and we have no method to collect the $12,000 he continues to owe. So that is but one example. Another example are frequently commercial truck drivers. They have an interstate run where they are not really tied to Oregon other than their CDL. Perhaps they have a homestead here and so forth, but they're on the road. They're very hard to track down. And what we found is that they are very amenable once they realize their driving privileges are subject to suspension to enter into an agreement and make sure we get the funds. In any event, I want to point out primarily that this is money that a custodial parent has expended for the benefit of the minor children at some point and not been had the contribution of that other parent. They've not stepped up to the plate and been responsible at some time in the past when the children were minors, which is why they have an arrearage. So our efforts here are obviously directed towards collecting the money that will help that family. It may be now used by that custodial parent to help that child with college because money that they could not set aside while the children were minors because they had to maintain the bare necessities for those children without the help of the other parent. So there are good public policy reasons certainly to expand this remedy and this tool, and certainly this expansion mirrors some trends in federal law where they've expanded tax offset, for example, to people for arrearages only on the federal level and other sorts of things. It's much less intensive than having to drag people in for contempt of court, and it's been very effective. Finally, it probably represents some amount of revenue to the state. It represents revenue in the sense that we get incentive revenue from the federal government. That incentive revenue is based on our collections. If we collect more money, we get more federal funds, very simply. So thank you, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Question. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have, I really appreciate your testimony, and the bill looks good to me, but I do have a question. Do we have data on the percentage of people who are employed and who we have wage garnishment and therefore the enforcement ratio of those folks versus self-employed people who aren't as easily subject to garnishment, and the enforcement ratio of those folks, or the ratio of the people who should be paying compared to the percentage of people who are paying? Do we have any comparative information about those two groups of people?
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, we do not have that exact data. We do have some data with us here today about the number of income withholdings that we issue and the amount of monies that come in from that. That, of course, as probably you're already aware by asking that question, is our primary enforcement tool. Our basic enforcement scheme is first to do income withholding if available. Second is to do tax offsets of refunds, and then also we do financial institution data matches and garnish accounts of various types to try to get money coming in on a regular basis. This tool then falls into the next category where none of those things work. They aren't employed by anyone. They aren't keeping financial accounts in their own names. It's either in a business or someone else's name, and we need to use the tool. To compare the ratio of income withholding to license suspension, we do not have that exact data. However, we could take a look at those two fields of data and bring that back to you.
That'd be handy. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair. Renal, talk to us about hunting and fishing licenses.
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, that is a good point. In Oregon, part of how we defined, and I erred in not explaining this to you, it is in my written testimony, the federal government does require all of the child support programs to have a license suspension program. In essence, then, they leave it to the states to define what that is and what it looks like. In Oregon, you all defined it for us to mean any, basically, occupational professional license, driver's licenses, commercial driver's license, and yes, hunting and fishing licenses, which is how we have defined recreational licenses in Oregon. We put that in 1997, spent some time on it in 1999 defining what that would look like. So the way that hunting and fishing in the real world plays out for us today is that if you either hunt or fish, and as some of you know, certainly Representative Krieger, and it involves the type of activity where you have to get an actual license at the time that you go in to your local mom and pop store to do so, if we have already certified your case, so to speak, and I'm using that term loosely, but we've sent in information that says you qualify, they won't let you get a license. Once you have a license, however, it's not that we have game wardens running around taking them away from you, certainly, so it's sort of a once a year, if we're lucky, type of suspension, but we do have the ability and do attempt to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, you talked about the challenges of collecting from somebody who might have a business account. My assumption is that S corporations, C corporations, LLCs, and limited liability partnerships would be shielded from any type of garnishment you might make on those accounts, but are sole proprietorships also, if it's just in the business name?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, I'm going to take the first shot and then defer over to Carl, but that is a very astute question. The department actually pre-session filed a bill that would have proposed, well, does propose to allow us to get into some of those corporate accounts because we are not able to. You are correct. On the sole proprietorship, though, I will defer. I am not an attorney. I do work for attorneys, but I'll defer to Carl to see if he knows the answer to that.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, generally speaking, if it's a sole proprietorship, then the individual's own assets can stand for their debt, because they're not identified to a corporate account necessarily, per se, where the corporation would shield it or an LLC would shield. Similarly, Subchapter S, I believe, is also generally protected liability.
Yeah.
So consequently, what we do find are some accounts where there are joint ownership in the account. As long as the individuals who are identified include one of the debtors, I think that generally that the entire account asset stands for the debt of any of the individual depositors.
If I could follow up, is that bill back from LC yet that would kind of pierce that corporate veil on?
Chair Barker and Representative Shields, the bill has dropped and been introduced. We are not actively pursuing it, so it's not on your schedule today or tomorrow because it is yet another very aggressive tool, and we chose to start asking you about this first. It's a proven, tried and proven method. We'd be happy to talk to you if you're interested in the other one, but we did not ask for it to be scheduled at this time.
You mean you don't want every corporation in the state bearing down on
you? This would be a very full room.
Okay.
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, we wanted to help you out a bit. Yes, we had several to choose from.
I just want to let you know I would be interested in that bill.
Okay, we'll get that to you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Olney, we've met a few times. You probably wouldn't recall, but I've actually read your briefing in a lot of different cases, ballot title cases, et cetera, and it's simply marvelous work. I really am a big fan, and I appreciate the fact that you chose to take the pay cut and go to work for the state. We're lucky to have you.
Thank you very much. And Chair Barker and Representative Barton, I'm terribly excited to be in this role. You know, Attorney General Kroger has said I'm responsible for all things children, and I am learning an enormous amount about the incredible work in a much broader range than I ever knew in my kind of narrow practice. So I appreciate the opportunity, and I'm very grateful to have these longtime experts at my side here today.
Thank you. And the only other thing I'd say is, while fishing licenses I'm sure are included, I think you're referring to angling licenses rather than fishing. Only game wardens would know about that. So. Any further discussion? Close the public hearing on 20. Thank you very much, panel. Close the hearing on House Bill 2273 and open a work session on House Bill 2273. Oh, okay. You can stay if you'd like, since you do.
Thank you.
Representative Barton take a motion to move this forward?
Mr. Chair, I move that we refer 2273 to the House with a new pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2273 to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Excused.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Excused.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnitz?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Representative Barton, if you'd carry that for us.
Of course.
Next item on the agenda, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2272. Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2272 mandates that every child support order must include a medical support clause. It comes from the Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
As I said in my earlier testimony, the Department of Justice is responsible for the child support program.
You need to identify yourself each time.
That's all I'm going to say.
Okay, thank you.
And my name is Margaret Only, Special Counsel to Attorney General John Kroger.
Thank you.
This bill is an important piece of legislation that relates to trying to increase the number of children who receive health insurance coverage or support for the health insurance health care costs from their parents. It is mandated again by the federal law, and we are required to include in every child support order a separate provision relating to health coverage or medical, or termed as medical support. And this is something that has been in Oregon law previously, and this bill seeks to bring some of our language, have it aligned with the federal standards, and in addition, the federal Department of Child Support Enforcement issued regulations that we are seeking to comply with in terms of who receives this, what these medical support orders look like. Child support order has to include a medical support order either for both parents if they have it available to provide medical insurance, health care insurance, or to provide cash medical assistance. And under the federal law, cash medical assistance, the order to provide health insurance is can only be ordered if the cost is reasonable and if it is accessible. This bill addresses the definitions that are going to be then fleshed out in administrative rule in Oregon about what is reasonable in cost and what is accessible. We also have -1 amendments. This is a very complicated area in trying to find the balance about what is, how we want to make sure parents still have cash in their pockets in order to put food on the table, and not have our child support orders be so high that they cannot do that if they have to spend a very high amount on their medical support. So we are proposing that our I have the wrong amendment in front of me. We are proposing that it be tied to the Oregon minimum wage for full-time employment, in part to have it be reasonable. And again, we are going to be fleshing this out through rulemaking. There are a variety of other semantic changes in this bill that the Child Support Division felt was necessary and would be useful to practitioners in order to have enforceable orders. One thing that's somewhat new here is that a medical support order is against both parents. It's against the custodial parent as well as the non-custodial parent. Both parents have an obligation to provide that support. I think I will let Rennell fill in some of the more technical details on this.
We're getting them right now.
Okay.
We thought we had them, but we don't.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, again for the record, Ron L. Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office. Margaret has covered the primary focus of this legislation. Just to reiterate, this is not new work. These are not, for the most part, new requirements. You passed a bill for us last session that had to do with this new federal mandate to have stricter laws regarding ordering health insurance coverage and medical support for Oregon's children, along with their cash support, and also enforcing those orders once they have them in place. As Margaret has pointed out, we have the ability in the law and will continue to order either or both parents to have coverage. The emphasis is to have our children covered with insurance of some type. And as she also indicated to you, if they don't have insurance available, then we need to be ordering them to contribute some form of cash to cover the costs. Ultimately, we know those children still go to the doctor. There still are expenses. They may be going to the emergency room. They may be on some sort of state assistance involving copays. So we will have that in the order. Just to tell you briefly, if you're looking at the bill, so as to make sure you know everything that is in there, it looks a little more exciting than it really is. There's a lot of bold text, but legislative counsel, every drafter is somewhat different than the former one, and they wanted to rewrite some of it to make it more understandable. So let me just point out to you Section 1, which is 25.321, are really all of the definitions. There is nothing totally new in there. It is trying to make them less redundant and more clear. In essence, we're going to use the general term medical support to mean either that health insurance coverage or that cash payment. That's the broad term that you will see used in support orders, and that's really what all those definitions are about. Section 2 is 25.323. Margaret has hit all the highlights for you. We can still order one or both parents. We have maintained the necessity for that insurance to be accessible. If the child can't use it, it makes no sense to order it. It also has to be reasonable in cost, and as she mentioned, we have worked with our partners at Legal Aid, and where we have, by rule, been using federal minimum wage, we are moving into statute that safeguard for the obligated parent, actually for both parents, depending on who we're ordering to pay, and we're switching it to the Oregon minimum wage so it's more consistent with the demographics of our state. The other thing I will point out, however, that she did not mention, and I want to make sure that you realize, we have added a resource savings piece, and it is in Section 2. If you go to page 3, line 32, you'll see the term contingency, and you will see some language that is new. What that says to the program, and I'm going to try to make this simple, because a guidelines calculation is very complicated, and when you throw in the factors of health insurance and cash medical support, it's even more complicated, so I'm not going to attempt to explain that. But what this says to the practitioners, at least in the child support program, and certainly the courts could choose to do so if they wish, is that when we have a scenario where we know that it's likely that the insurance coverage for the child is going to be changing over time, we can put some contingency language in there and do all of the appropriate calculations according to the guidelines to say, right now this is the scenario, right now this is what the insurance costs, we're factoring it in. If that insurance were to go away, these are the average costs for the child over the year, and it may revert over to a cash payment, but we'll build in some of those options in some of our orders, not all, so that we can, by administrative process, then continue that coverage, continue giving appropriate credit to the parents, but not have to do a modification every time someone changes jobs, and therefore every time someone has a new insurance carrier that really doesn't impact the calculation. That's the goal of that contingency language. Not totally exciting, but very important to some of those families, because it's much faster to be able to do an administrative process than to do a full modification to continue that coverage. Again, as Margaret said, we will continue to use the guidelines as we do today, and then we do have rulemaking authority. As we currently do, we continue so that we can work out all the details that the courts and the practitioners need from us. The amendments I hope you have before you, we can answer any questions, but primarily it is that change from the federal minimum wage or a federal poverty level threshold to the Oregon minimum wage. That's the only significant change. And there's no fiscal impact since this is existing work that we're already doing.
Thank you. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, can you tell us how this would apply, if at all, to TANF cases where the child is on Medicaid?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, we certainly do have a great number of our families where the children qualify, if not the parents, for some type of state coverage through health insurance programs such as the Oregon Health Plan. What we do in those instances and what we will build into the order is, first we look to see if either parent has private insurance available, because that would be the first option. And if it has been a scenario where perhaps perhaps the non-custodial parent has that but did not enroll the child, then we have the ability to order it and to, in fact, force enrollment for that child and get them on. That's existing law. It will continue. If neither parent has that available, which is common in Oregon, based on our population and our demographics and a lot of small employers that can't provide insurance that will meet the criteria for reasonable and cost for these families, they may have the child on state assistance, in which case we will order that they continue to have that occur as long as they qualify, and we will factor in any co-payments that might be associated with that to make sure that both of the parents are assisting with any of those co-payments. So that's kind of the important provision of that. If the child's on state assistance but there is some cash outlay involved, we want to make sure both parents are sharing in those costs. And then ultimately, if they do not qualify to have state assistance, we're going to look just purely to some sort of cash assistance for medical coverage.
Ask a follow-up. So we're not requiring if the child is on Medicaid for the parent who does not have insurance to pay completely for the Medicaid for the child.
Chair Barker and Representative Shields, our guidelines calculations basically are a shared income model, which means both parents are responsible for basic child support. Likewise, we do a shared model when attributing the amount to cover for insurance. It's assumed that the parent with physical custody, so in your scenario, the parent that went in and put the children on that that medical assistance, is already carrying that burden by the fact that they have the child and they went in and signed up for the program and are making the payments. And so it's the absent parent that will try to fill in the gap. So technically they're both paying. We only collect from the one that does not physically have the child.
Can I ask one more follow-up?
Yes,
so but are you talking about just a copay, so it's just a portion of the actual cost of it? I mean, paint a picture for me. What would, let's say, somebody who's making, you know, $12 an hour and their child is on Medicaid and their mom is on TANF, what would they be paying in this kind of scenario?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, I must confess I'm not familiar with all the medical programs in Oregon and how they play out, but let's say that you have your child on some sort of a state program, whether it's through Department of Human Services or some other group plan, and the mom has physical custody, qualifies for this plan, and has $100 that she has to also pay towards coverage every month. We're going to factor in that $100. We're going to factor in that out-of-pocket cost to make sure the other parent helps pay. If all things were completely equal, let's say they're both minimum wage parents, so we have a 50-50 calculation, we're going to require that father pay $50 of that $100 that the mother was formerly paying.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm glad you mentioned subsection under section 2, number 3, because I'm still not clear exactly the wording, and maybe I'm just reading it too literally. It talks about that a medical support clause may require that it be provided in more than one form, and may require that it be provided in a particular form contingent on the availability of another form of medical support. I'm like going around in circles on that one, so maybe you can sort of give me a for instance, because it's not real clear from what you've got here.
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, that's exactly why we need rulemaking authority. Do you want to take that one? I'll take it if you don't. I've had a lot of scenarios.
Well, you know, you're probably going to be a little bit more specific. I believe I understand how this is, but I'm probably operating more from Representative Stiegler's perspective on how this plays out, so I will defer to Ronell on that.
We're trying, Chair Barker and Representative Stiegler, we're trying to anticipate every possible scenario, number one. But an example that would be common is perhaps, using my earlier example, perhaps the non-custodial parent has insurance available and there's a certain cost and we factor it in. But this non-custodial parent has a fairly transient job where they move from job to job and the next employer does not have it. And because of that history and that pattern, we could, for example, have an order in place that says as long as insurance is available through their employer and as long as it's within this guidelines calculation, you're going to carry your child on your insurance. However, we may also know that that child has regular medical costs that can be anticipated, such as the child has childhood diabetes, and we can factor that in. If we know there's a possibility that health insurance will be lost, and we know there will be a certain cost ongoing, we may build that in as well and say, contingent on that loss of health insurance, we will roll over or revert to this cash payment per month. It could absolutely work in the reverse as well. We could have an obligor who doesn't currently have insurance available. We order the cash payment but says, I know I'm going to have this new job with insurance. I don't qualify. It's coming up. A variety of things, and we can build that in so that we can, in essence, turn it on and turn it off as long as it stays within those guidelines calculation in that particular order. At any time that their income changes or the cost of the insurance or the medical change significantly enough, we need to go back to doing a full modification so you have an appropriate calculation.
So, a follow-up, Mr. Chair. So, what you're saying is that this would give the court the ability to enter as part of the medical support order. This is what the order is, but if, for instance, in your example, if insurance is lost under those circumstances, then these particular costs would be paid 50-50 by each parent. Is that what you're sort of saying?
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, I think that is sort of what I'm saying. I think the more likely scenario would be that we believe that a father, let's say, or a mother, a parent has a certain income, and that a reasonable amount of money for that parent to be spending on health care would be tied to that reasonable amount we just talked about, and that in lieu of purchasing the health insurance, that party may then have a presumed amount that he or she is going to have to contribute towards the cash medical costs.
So essentially then the order would read, you provide the insurance so long as it's available to you, but if it becomes unavailable to you, this is your cash contribution.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Oh, not your Honor.
That's okay. It works, too. Hey, you know, I... okay. I'm sitting here reading this sort of trying to put myself in a judge's position. You know, I've been there, done that enough times to have them go, I'm not sure what the legislature intended by this clause in here, and so that's I'm just trying to be real clear as to what that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
That, you know, insurance might be available, or one contingency might be available, but what you want is you want to try to avoid multiple modifications of the child support order, and so what you're going to do is try to build in as much play, much flexibility in that order as possible. I'm assuming that's the intention of this particular clause?
Yes, and Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, I think that the goal is to not have a disincentive for a parent to not cover, but make sure, you know, so that they're going to be paying for that health insurance or health care costs in one way or another, and to have continuity on that. And this is a proposal that I understand, and the development of this was prior to Attorney General Kroger coming in, but that has been discussed at length with advisory committee that includes the courts. So this contingency language is something that we believe we can do that will help streamline the process, minimize our administrative costs, give certainty to the parties. I recognize, as somebody who did some family law at one period, it's a kind of unusual in the private sector to be thinking about a contingency order in that context. But we believe that it will work and be more efficient.
And Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, if I might just add, in all cases, it would be an actual dollar amount, so the parents will know. It wouldn't ever be a percentage amount. It's not that fluid. Modifications, health insurance changes much more rapidly than income, so that's a large percentage of our modifications. And again, if I wasn't clear in my testimony, I apologize. We have really placed this in the statute anticipating that the child support program will use it, because we do a large volume of modifications of both underlying administrative and judicial orders. It is available because of the chapter that it's in to the courts, but it is certainly not required for the judges to use this flexibility if they don't wish to do so.
See, Mr. Chair, I told you she was a good lawyer.
I'm just trying to, you know, I applaud that. I'm just as a follow-up, Your Honor. See there, I'm calling him Your Honor. Good Lord. Catching here today, Mr. Chair. I'm just not sure that I'm still sort of, you know, it's one of those kind of things where you read it and reread it, and sometimes you get yourself confused by trying to be too analytical. So I will take you that that's what this intends. We may be back in 2 years tweaking it, so to speak.
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, if I may, I think that when we talk about the form and you're looking at that subsection, It's on page 3, line 32. I think that it makes more sense when you refer back to the types of health insurance coverage, medical coverage, that are set out in the definitional section.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 150% of federal poverty guidelines. What is that now? Do you know about?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, I apologize. I do not have that available with me today.
Cut line. So, in other words, if you were $5 under, you wouldn't pay. And if you're $5 over, it's 100% pay?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, it's correct that it's a line in the sand. Remember, it's just a qualifier of whether or not we're going to order the insurance as affordable, and then we still do an entire child support calculation to determine how much of that you pay. Correct.
Okay. And Representative Barker, Chair Barker and Representative Krieger, if I may, it's also if the person isn't ordered to purchase health insurance, they may nonetheless be ordered to do a cash medical support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In today's obviously insurance market, like you said, Rennell, is changing quicker than wages. On line 44 on page 3, it says is reasonable in cost and does not require the payment of unreasonable deductibles or co-payments. How are those determined as being reasonable or unreasonable?
Chair Barker and Representative Cameron, for the most part, we lay out those further details in our series of guidelines rules and then in our medical support rule, because it all factors back to income and ability to pay and that safety valve threshold that we have. So when we are evaluating a particular plan and the cost associated with that plan, we're going to start out, quite honestly, looking at just the premiums. But if the obligor points out to us, yes, I have three choices, but look at this one, it has these factors, we will calculate those dollar factors in and make a determination probably in that scenario that is not the best, most accessible, most reasonable insurance to be ordered. We're going to work with the parties to ensure that this is insurance that will get used and be affordable.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schenkel, did we discuss this in my office previously, this one?
Chair Barker and Representative Wisnett, I think our discussion was probably about this long. We're bringing back the medical support provisions from last session and updating the definitions and putting a cost savings, resource savings in, but we did not go into detail.
Follow up, please. It's confusing. I thought our objective here is to comply with the federal and have a plan, and I don't understand why we're talking about 150% of poverty level and we're talking about a minimum wage. You're really confusing me, and I'm sure that I'll agree with the rules you develop. We always agree with the rules you develop. But
Chair Barker and Representative Wisnett, that's a very good point. And let me point out again, we have by rule been putting that poverty threshold in there. We initially rolled that over to statute so you could lock it in, so to speak, for us and make sure that threshold's there. And then we're asking a further amendment and switch it from federal poverty calculation to a state minimum wage. So in essence, we're saying lock us in and make sure that threshold stays in place by statute. But you're hearing all this dialogue from us because the guidelines calculation ultimately is the place where we figure out if we can even have these parents afford the health insurance, and it's extremely calculated, extremely difficult calculation to go through. We'd be more than happy to come and go through a guidelines calculation with you. It may be beneficial. It's a little overwhelming.
Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate that. I'll give a vote for yes, but I'd like to maybe have further discussion.
Okay.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a general question that I could have asked about any of our child support bills, and that is, do we have any idea what, when both parents petition for custody, do we have data that suggests if there's any current gender preference and to what degree that gender preference is when those requests are made? So when is the question unclear?
A little bit, so yes.
Okay. What percentage of the time is it the mom that gets custody versus what percentage of the time when the dad gets custody? In particular, I'm interested in times when they both request it.
Chair Barker and Representative Smith, that is not data that I'm that is not within the purview of the Child Support Division and our mission here.
Yeah.
We're not involved in ordering parenting plans or custody at all. So what comes to us are parties, either a court-established order already,
yeah,
or a parent who says, I have custody of the child,
yeah,
I have custody of the child. So that is not any kind of data that we would have.
Mr. Taylor, you want to?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I see Representative Stiegler has a hand up. This is child support bill, not a custody issue.
I hear that, and I still have my question.
Okay, go ahead. Follow up.
Yeah, we can take it off. It's still relevant to me, right? I mean, how this is actually going to play out in the world? It's not going to probably. My vote is probably not going to hinge upon the answer either way. But as we're, it is not a. Thinking about how this plays out in lives matters to me, right? I think it should matter to us, and how it matters and how it plays out in communities should matter to us. And I am us saying, well, we're not sure right now. It's totally acceptable answer saying. You know, we're the left hand. We're not worried about what the right hand is doing. That's a different answer that I'm hoping for over time. We can talk about it after if you want.
Okay, one more. Representative Stiegler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All I'd offer to Representative Smith in this is that after 18 years of practice in this area, the statutes, the laws, the administrative rules are gender neutral.
Mm-hmm.
How they may be applied is a whole different issue.
Does anybody know?
Pardon?
Does anybody know?
I don't think it's quantifiable. As to whether or not they are applied. You know, I mean, I think people are going to have their opinions as to whether the application has been gender neutral in a particular case. But I don't think that there's quantifiable data necessarily as far as.
Michelle, we can take it offline. I don't want to take too much time with the committee, but I think it's something that's definitely quantifiable.
Okay,
Chair Barker, if I might just clarify, though, for the record, since we have this line of questioning, which we're happy to talk about, and we do have a statistic from our program, but let me be clear on child support. The child support program and the Oregon Child Support Guidelines are established absolutely and completely based on physical custody of a child. In fact, there are many cases in Oregon where neither the legal father or the legal mother have the child, but foster care parents, grandparents, and so on are raising children. Child support is based on physical custody. Custody orders and parenting time do factor into these complicated guidelines calculations, and we are consistently looking at those to make sure that the families are getting all the credit they're due as that relates to the monetary obligation. We simply don't handle the actual establishment of those custody and parenting times. We do have the statistics, if you want to know, in our program of males and females that are obligors, but that's up to you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I have one other question. The amendment says that it applies to Section 10 on page 12. After, is that correct?
One moment, we'll look.
Again, it just may be one of those things where the obvious is evading me.
It is wrong.
Yeah, more than I'd like to have.
Page 12.
It says on page 12, after line 1, insert, and then it says Section 10. Am I reading that correctly? But I look at the Section 10 that's there on page 12 of the current bill.
Chair Barker and Representative Stiegler, I think Mr. Taylor has answered, but it appears to be a numbering issue.
Okay, thank you.
So Chair, members of the committee, Representative Stiegler, when you go to the back of the amendment, what it does is it says delete Section 10 and insert Section 11 on line 2.
Oh, there it is.
So the end of the amendment simply renumbers the rest of the section.
Go to that again. Delete number 10, okay, and
line
2, right?
This is a lot, yes.
And insert
delete
11.
Delete 10 and insert 11. So what you have here, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is there's an insertion of a new section 10.
That's right.
And then the renumbering of section 10.
Okay.
Now 10 is 11, and section 11 is section 12.
I just wanted to make sure, so you have a new section 10? No. A new section 10?
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, yes. It would simply be. So what you have before you would now be section 10. Section 10 would become section 11. Section 11 would become section 12.
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, drafting child support bills is probably one of the least desirable assignments in legislative council. I agree with Mr. Taylor that We do not currently have 25333 in this bill, so rather than inserting it numerically and renumbering all of the sections, I believe what he's sharing with you is they're saying, great, on the back page we're going to add this new language and then we're going to renumber those last two sections, and then when we get to the end of session, of course, they will put the statutes in order for us, but they didn't want to redo all of these pages, I'm quite certain.
We have the dash one amendments, I think, have been explained. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2272 and open a work session on House Bill 2272.
Mr. Chair, I'll move dash one amendments to House Bill 2272 be adopted.
The amendments dash ones to House Bill 2272. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2272 to the as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2272 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Excused.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Excused.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Witness?
Aye.
Chair Barton?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Cameron, would you carry this for us, please? Thank you. Next item on the agenda is I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2274. Mr. Taylor.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2274 comes also again from the Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division, allows the Department of Justice or the District Attorney to request the Department of Revenue to collect past due child support from an obligor's tax refund when the obligor's child is incarcerated in a closed custody facility of the Oregon Youth Authority.
Thank you
very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Only. I'm Special Counsel to Attorney General John Kroger, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2274. This is a technical fix to our legislation that would allow us to continue to provide collection services through a tax intercept for on behalf of children who are in close custody with the Oregon Youth Authority. The Child Support Division collects child support from parents and transfers those funds to the Oregon Youth Authority when children are under their jurisdiction, are being held there. We received an audit last year which said that we could not use our 4D funds to collect child support on behalf of children who were not in the not receiving Medicaid or otherwise in the Title IV program. What that meant is that we lost our authorization to do the tax intercepts, because that authorization is tied to whether or not the child is eligible for services, receives Medicaid, TANF, or another 4D program. So this bill is simply asking you to give us the authority to use tax intercepts in order to help collect child support and defray the costs for children who are in the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority. This is, I would say, now when we do this collection activity for the Oregon Youth Authority, we are having to use our general fund dollars exclusively because we no longer get a federal match for that. But really, we're a good investment for the state, and we think it's an appropriate thing to be doing, because when we collect those funds, it costs us less, and we're then able to help fund the Oregon Youth Authority. So that's what this bill is about, and I think Rennell can speak to a few more details on it.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, very briefly, in the history of Oregon, when what was Children's Services Division split out of the Department of Human Services and became standalone agency of Oregon Youth Authority, you made a legislative policy choice to have the Child Support Program to continue to provide services to both of those agencies, which we have done since that time. The federal government does require child support programs as one of our many requirements to have state and federal tax offset programs. We've had those since pre-1997. They work very well. Both from our perspective and those of parents. And in essence, we just need to make sure we can keep using that tool as we continue to work on the Oregon Youth Authority cases. This is not a new tool. This is something we've already been doing. An audit just pointed out that technically our statute is not exactly in compliance because we do work these particular cases with all state general funds and no federal matching funds. And so we simply need to clean this up.
Questions? Representative Krieger. Now, let me try to clarify. If Johnny is in the home with the parents and they separate and one gets custody and then he goes to the youth authority, then neighborhood's obligator would have to pay.
Chair Barker and Representative Krieger, partly true, partly correct. In all foster care cases and all Oregon Youth Authority cases, if the child is not residing in the physical custody of either parent, we are actually referred two cases, one against the mother and one against the father. We do work them separately in Oregon to establish two separate legal obligations that can be enforced, but we do pursue both parents. There are some exceptions in those agencies for certain scenarios, but they're very limited. Generally, we work a case against each parent for each of these youth.
Okay, I think I've got that. Now, if Johnny goes to the Oregon Youth Authority after the separation, I can understand that. But what if he goes and there is no separation, there is no back anything? Do you still collect from those parents?
Chair Parker, Representative Krieger, yes, we do. The policy decision was made back in time when the Legislative Assembly asked us to pursue parents to collect support for these youth offenders, as well as foster care children, to offset the cost of the state, basically providing room and board for the children. Remember, the Oregon Child Support Guidelines basically are established to provide a child with room and board. In that scenario, whether it's through no fault of the parents or involvement of the parents, the child is not in the physical custody of either parent, and we will pursue them, again, with limited exceptions by those agencies based on the individual case scenarios. If they are together, we will still serve each of the parents. They will each have a case. In order to make it simpler for them, they often have their administrative hearings at the same time, talk to us by conference call. They can work together, but it is two separate obligations.
If I think they could stay within Oregon Youth Authority, was it age 22 before they would be moved to the state pen if it was a longer sentence?
25.
How long does this go to age 18?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, all child support for all types of cases in Oregon, regardless of the location of the child, is until age 18 or 21 if they qualify under a very specific statute as a child attending school. So it would be until 18 for certain. It could be longer depending on what program that youth is in and whether or not they qualify under that separate statute.
Okay.
To be a student until 21.
Sure.
Further questions? Sure. No further questions. If there's no discussion, close the public hearing on House Bill 2274, open a work session. I'd entertain a motion to send House Bill 224 to the floor to do pass on the consensus on the consent calendar.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Stegler moves House Bill 2274 to the floor on the consent calendar with the do pass recommendation. Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Excused.
Representative
Krieger?
Aye.
Representative
Olson? Excused.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stegler?
Aye.
Chair Wizard?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. To the consent calendar. The next item on the agenda is a public hearing only today on House Bill 2275. It is not ready to be worked. But we just did. Okay, we just got it. Never mind. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2275. Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2275 comes to you from the Department of Justice. Support Enforcement Division clarifies that a person eligible for and receiving assistance pursuant to Title 4, Subsection A of the Social Security Act is presumed not able to pay child support, allows a person seeking relief from an out-of-state support enforcement order to challenge the order in the originating state or in this state. One in this state would be somewhat challenges. Chair, members of the committee, you should also have, or you soon will have, the Dash 1 amendments in front of you, which does not require the past support arrears owed for a child be assigned to the state at the time of the application of temporary assistance to needy families.
Thank you very much, Chair Barker and members of the committee. This is Sorry. My name is Margaret Olney, Special Counsel Attorney General John Kroger. And with that, actually, I'm going to defer to Ronell Shankle on this one. This is a bill that contains a number of technical fixes to kind of clean up a number of our child support and collection laws.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, the child support program has so many complicated laws that we often come before you with these cleanups, as was implied earlier in one of our other bills. Let me just take you very briefly through the sections and tell you what it does to make sure that there's no part or provision that you're uncomfortable with in this cleanup bill. Section 1, which is ORS 25245, has to do with an existing law that you have given us that makes it a rebuttable presumption that if you have an obligor that is basically so poor that he or she qualifies for Social Security income or TANF themselves, that we do not establish a child support order against them during that period when they're on assistance themselves or collect support. That is something that over the years was amended to make clear, first of all, that we do that if it's federal Social Security. Then it was for Oregon TANF or whatever we may call that program at any particular time, and also expanded it to out of state because we have many interstate families. Last session, another bill, not a child support bill, touched this statute and changed the language because of some language changes, I believe, in the Department of Human Services on what we call our various grants. Inadvertently, it cut us off from the ability to also apply this to other states' grants that call them something different. So we simply need to put more generic language in to continue the intent that you gave us, which is to give those persons a rebuttable presumption and a break potentially against their child support when they are at that low income level. Section 2, 25405, has to do with interstate cases. I will tell you this is, you have to read in a circle in the statutes to figure this one out. Mr. Taylor and I spent 45 minutes making sure he was comfortable. It says what it does what we say it does, which is to explain to our customers that if you get an income withholding from another state directly in Oregon, no Oregon child support case. You haven't asked us for services, probably because the children are living elsewhere, but the obligor is here. Under the interstate laws, let's say Washington can send an income withholding directly to an employer without our involvement. This clarifies how that obligor gets to object and have their due process in their hearings, whether it be coming to us or going directly to court. So it's just clarifying that process for those obligors that already exist but simply wasn't clear. Section 3 and 4 has a series in 25.643 through 646. These literally are going through and changing some terminology related to our financial institution data matches and garnishments and getting the information we need to do those administrative garnishments. When this law was originally implemented in Oregon, it was a centralized team within the Department of Justice that did all of these statewide. So it says Department of Justice is entitled to this information. As you heard in testimony earlier, of course, the child support program is made up of district attorneys and division of child support offices, and we both need the ability to get this information, so it simply changes that terminology so this work can be done at the local offices and not always obtained centrally. Section 5, ORS 107.135, has to do with credit that we give to obligors when their children are the beneficiaries of Social Security benefits or veterans benefits. It's specific with regard to arrears and monies that come in to those families, not part of the monthly ongoing benefits, but often a payment or a judgment up front when you first qualify. We originally put the term lump sum in there. We'd like to take that out to make sure it's flexible and covers all of the scenarios so that we're giving all of those families the credit that they deserve. And Section 6, ORS 416, Chapter 416 is our administrative process chapter, and this is to add clarification
to us for the program
that when you have already an existing order in place, we can, whether or not we issue a second new order for that family unit or do a modification. The goal of a course would be to have us do a modification and not have multiple orders for the same family unit, and this clarifies that that's what we should do, modify the underlying order, even if we have the families moving from county to county or additional children being added, so it will eliminate confusion. There are some -1 amendments. I hope the committee has those before you, and this is adding adding ORS 412024. That is a welfare statute. It's not a child support statute. But one of the things that we are gearing up to implement that came with the Deficit Reduction Act last session when you passed our laws was a good new change coming in October for families. Today, if a family goes in and signs up for support, for TANF, and if they already have a support order and there are arrears, they also assign their rights to those arrears to the state. Beginning in October, they will not have to do that. When they go in and sign up for TANF, in essence, they'll assign over their monthly support for those months that their children are on welfare, but those arrears will still be able to be owed to that parent. That's a good distribution scheme. The federal government asked us to do it. Oregon is going to do it, but we literally need the TANF welfare paperwork to say that same thing. So we need to change their statute.
Representative Krieger.
Ronell, the rebuttable presumption, unable to pay, presumed unable to pay, is that an incentive to stay in the programs and have unreported income and cash type things so you stay below that level?
Chair Barker and Representative Krieger, I believe you're speaking to our obligated parents perhaps qualifying themselves for welfare and therefore getting out of child support. I will tell you there are times when people work the system and figure out how to do that. Most often that happens when the family is actually residing together but not reporting that way. Often that does get reported by other family members, friends, and neighbors, and we do not address that issue, but the welfare or the TANF department does have an investigative unit that handles that. And people will be bumped off of assistance if it is not a valid, appropriate grant being issued to them. When that grant closes, we're right back in there asking for child support.
Just real quick. I just want to be clear. I understand you've changed the terminology throughout to administrator, both from department and Department of Justice. And that's to sort of be more all-inclusive. Is administrator defined somewhere else?
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, very good question. In Chapter 25, the administrator is specifically defined and used throughout that statute to mean both the Department of Justice and the county district attorneys.
Okay.
Once again, a technical fix. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2275, open work session on House Bill 2275, and we have the dash ones.
Move that we adopt the dash one amendments in 2275.
Representative Wisnant moves the dash one amendments in House Bill 2275. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Next, I entertain a motion to move this to the consent.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2275 is amended to be sent to the House with a new pass recommendation on the consent agenda.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2275 with dash one to the floor with a due pass to the consent agenda.
Mr. Chair, did you say it's going to the consent agenda?
It is. Consent calendar. I'm sorry. Any further questions? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Excused.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative
Olson?
Excused.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carried. Is there any further business before the committee today? Hearing none.